test is in four parts: part 1, part 2, part 3, and part 4. Now look at part 1.
Part 1.
You will hear a woman phoning about her membership of a carpool, a type of car sharing organization. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 4. Listen carefully to the first part of the conversation and answer questions 1 to 4.
Hello, your carpool. How can I help?
Oh, hello. Look, I used one of the cars earlier and I want to complain. I'm not one to make a fuss usually, but this isn't the first time there's been a problem. I'm getting fed up with it.
I'm sorry to hear that. Can I take your membership number first?
Yes, it's 520016.
520016. Is that Julie speaking?
Yes, Julie Gold.
Hi, Julie. Now, let me just check your booking. Your complaint's about the most recent booking, is it?
Well, yes, this complaint is. But like I say, it's not the first.
OK, so that was the Fiat. Registration number YPT723S in City Street this morning at 10:30?
Yes, that's it. But no, I think it was the car in Baker Road.
My records say City Street. That's the grey Fiat.
Oh, yes. Baker Road was yesterday.
And that booking was fine?
Well, yes, that one was.
Good. So what exactly was the problem today, then?
Now you have some time to look at questions 5 to 10. Now listen to the rest of the conversation and answer questions 5 to 10.
OK, I went to pick the car up and it wasn't in the parking bay. I was in quite a hurry and I have to say it was very stressful. Of course, I thought somebody else still had the car out. Anyway, I was about to phone when I saw the car on the other side of the street about 100 metres down. Can't you make it clear to users that they have to park the cars back in the bays?
Well, yes, we do. If I had to guess, I'd say that the previous user left it there because the bay was occupied. We'll phone to check and find out, but that's the most likely explanation.
But people aren't supposed to be occupying the parking bays, are they?
Well, no, but they do. They usually think it's okay to park for a few minutes.
Well, in that case, shouldn't members wait until somebody comes back to get their vehicle? I mean, in that situation, I always hoot and keep on hooting to alert the car owner to the fact I'm there and that I expect them to move. It usually takes only a few minutes. I wish people would show a little more patience.
As I say, I'll phone and...
There are other things I want to discuss. When I did eventually get to the car, I was shocked at how filthy it was, both inside and out. The wheels and the bottom of the vehicle were covered in mud. Inside, the carpets were muddy too, and the back seat covered in dog hair. It's pretty obvious that the last user had driven out to the country to take his dogs out walking. Can't there be some rules about what people can and can't use the cars for?
I hear what you're saying, Julie. I think this is a fair point, and I'm very sorry. I certainly will call the previous user to take this up.
And make sure that the cars are given a decent valeting every so often. Right, one more thing. Once I'd dusted off the seat and found the keys, I expected them to be left under a seat or in the door compartment, I finally started up the engine. I was dismayed to see how low the fuel gauge was. This has been the case before, and it's really annoying. I thought the membership regulations state quite clearly that it's the driver's responsibility to fill up when the gauge goes below the quarter full mark. Am I right?
Yes, that is what we say.
So how come I had to sort that out before I could get on with my journey?
Look, I think all things considered, we'll compensate you for your experience today. How does that sound, Julie?
Are you going to scrap the payment for today's booking?
Well, I could do that, but now the booking's on the system, it's complicated. I'd rather offer you complimentary hours. Today's booking was for 4 hours, so we'll say you have 4 hours of uncharged usage taken off your next bill.
But what if my next booking is for less than 4 hours?
Don't worry. The booking will not be charged and the remaining amount will automatically go forward to the booking after that. All you have to do is key free hours into the comments option when you make the booking online.
OK. I guess I should say thank you, but I'm still very cross.
That is the end of part one.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now it turns to part two.
Part two.
You will hear a woman talking about health and safety when using a computer.
First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 17. Now, listen carefully and answer questions 11 to 17.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the second session on health and safety. And today we're focusing on health and safety when using a computer. Now, can you all gather round this workstation here? That's great, thanks. Okay, now, let's look at some equipment that is specifically designed for safe computer use. Firstly, take a look at this item here. Yes, the sloped slab in front of the keyboard. Does anyone know what it is? That's right, it's a wrist rest. And it does a lot more than take up room on your desk, I can tell you. Well, what does it do exactly? In actual fact, it's specifically designed to support your wrist when you're typing or when you're using a computer mouse. Now, the one I'm holding in my hand is made of foam rubber. Come on now, have a feel. You know you want to. Now, it's very flexible, isn't it? The padding is firm, but it also gives way when you press it, just like this. Here's another type, by the way. This one is filled with gel. Now, like the foam rubber type, it's got a firm surface, but when you press it like this, it gives way with a little spring. However, not all wrist rests are flexible like that. Some are made from hard plastic. That doesn't sound like a comfortable support for your wrist, does it? So, not to be recommended. OK, so we know what kind of material we're looking for in a wrist rest. But what else do we have to think about before we choose one? Now, look again at the foam rubber wrist rest here. you can see that the slope of the wrist rest and the height and the width too match the front edge of the keyboard here. And there are no sharp edges. Look, it's really nice and smooth. Now, we know it's a busy time for you all at the moment. You're busy with assignments in between the hours you're spending browsing the net and going on social networking sites. Well, just think about how hard your wrist has to work. So, using a wrist rest like this one can really help in a number of ways. First of all, it helps you keep your wrist straight when you're using your computer. I'm demonstrating this now. As you can see, my wrist is neutral and straight rather than bent up and down. See what I mean? Now, it can also provide padding for your hands. It works in much the same way as a cushion, so it makes your desk much more comfortable. Now, please note, I did say cushion rather than pillow. We don't want you students to be too comfortable. Another advantage of a wrist rest is that it stops your hands from dropping off the edge of the keyboard. A wrist rest can also relieve tension and soreness in your neck and shoulders. And how does it do that exactly? Well, it removes the weight of your arm from your shoulders and neck altogether. So there are a lot of benefits, aren't there? However, most people never learn how to use a wrist rest correctly. In fact, leaning your wrists on a wrist rest for long periods can put a lot of pressure on the undersides of your wrists, just here.
Now you have some time to look at questions 18 to 20. Now listen to the rest of the talk and answer questions 18 to 20.
So, to make the most of your wrist rest, it's really important to follow a few basic tips. First of all, make sure you place your wrist rest approximately 1.5 inches away from your keyboard, like this. And never ever place your wrists directly on your wrist rest. Instead, place the palm or ball of your hand on the rest. And another thing, don't use the wrist rest all the time, particularly when you're typing. Instead, your hands should be on the wrist rests during break periods, so between your typing sessions. This will avoid you putting strain on your wrists and fingers. Now, does anyone have any questions before we move on to computer glasses?
That is the end of part two.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now it turns to part three.
Part three.
You will hear three students discussing the issue of waste deposited in space.
First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 26. Now listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 26.
Hey, did you manage to go to the talk by Dr. Chadwick this morning, Andy?
I was there. What happened to you, Sam?
My bike had a puncture. Seriously. Anyway, Ruth, I bet you took some notes. Can you fill me in?
Sure. It was all about space junk. Really interesting, actually. I mean, I knew about how much rubbish humans are dumping here on planet Earth, but I had no idea how much junk there is flying around in space. Did you know that there are literally millions of pieces of rubbish orbiting the Earth as we speak?
Not until now, I didn't.
They reckon that around 100 tons of very small objects, like mainly dust, drops on Earth every single day.
Yes, that's what she said.
I thought space junk was all man-made. I can't believe they know so accurately how much is actually out there. Do they track and monitor it all the time?
Yeah, they do. According to the talk, there are nearly 25,000 objects larger than 10 centimetres in diameter now orbiting the Earth.
And what does all this space junk consist of? Isn't it all discarded parts of rockets that were either broken or left behind after space missions, like Apollo and all those spacecraft from years ago?
Well, yes, but not only that. All other kinds of debris that we've dumped in space too. Anything from dead satellites to loose metal screws. There are even tiny particles of paint and liquid coolant.
So who is to blame for depositing all this rubbish? Where does it come from?
Well, I knew you were going to ask me that, Sam. So, hang on. You can take some of my notes if you like.
Thanks a lot. That's really helpful.
Here, look. Over a third, 37% to be exact, comes from Russia. But other countries are close behind. Another third, well, just under actually, 29% is from America, and then 28% is from China.
Yes, but other countries, like India, are adding to the rubbish pile. And don't forget the European Space Agency also has spacecraft in orbit.
That's true. We're talking serious space junk here.
Pretty serious, I'd say. So come on, what do you think are the chances of something solid dropping from space onto our heads?
Good question. Everyone asked that. Dr. Chadwick said at least one piece of junk falls to Earth every single day. But look at it this way. Earth is a pretty big place, so actually, the statistical chances of being hit are extremely low.
You now have some time to look at questions 27 to 30. Now listen to the rest of the discussion and answer questions 27 to 30.
So are you saying I'm more likely to win the lottery?
Well, just think about it. Two-thirds of the Earth is ocean.
That's true. But in time, almost all these pieces of rubbish will fall to Earth because the object's orbit is decreased by its gravitational pull. But the good news is that they don't cause any serious damage. You know, they can't actually survive the heat generated on re-entry. They simply burn away.
But that's not always the case. There are exceptions. Chunks of the United States UARS satellite recently fell into the Pacific Ocean.
The UARS satellite?
It was this 6-ton satellite launched by the Space Shuttle Discovery way back in 1991. So it had been up in space for 20 years, but stopped working in 2005. It weighed 5,700 kilos.
And that's about the same as a double-decker bus, apparently.
And, just check my notes, here it is, yes. The largest of these great big chunks that fell into the sea weighed about 158 kilograms. Think of the weight of an adult gorilla, Sam, and you get the picture.
A nice soft landing, then.
Dr. Chadwick said, imagine a couple of washing machines tied together and travelling at 100 miles per hour and you'll get an idea. Oh, and do you remember Skylab? That was another US space station, and it fell to Earth at least 3 decades ago, in 1979. It fell into the Indian Ocean and the deserts of Western Australia.
According to what I wrote down, that particular space junk weighed 100 tons. And let's not forget Mir, the Russian space station. Mir weighed 135 tons, far, far larger than UARS, and it fell to Earth in 2001. It plunged straight into the South Pacific.
All very interesting. Listen, I've got some junk of my own to sort out. My bike. That's a second puncture this week.
Come on, I'll help you fix it.
That is the end of part three.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part four.
Part four.
You will hear a man talking about tourism and the environment. First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40. Listen carefully to the talk and answer questions 31 to 40.
Good morning, everyone. Let's make a start. Now, over the last few weeks, we've looked at some key areas in the travel and tourism module. We've already charted the origins and development of tourism, and we've also looked at the negative effects of tourism on both local communities and the environment. So, in this lecture, we're going to focus on ways in which tourists can actually benefit local people and natural areas if they travel responsibly. And this kind of travel is known as ecotourism. Now, there's no one definition of ecotourism. In fact, it can be interpreted in a number of different ways. This means it represents different things to different people. And sometimes people misunderstand ecotourism altogether. They think of it as just spending time in nature or natural areas. However, the truth is far more complex. In essence, it aims to minimize the negative impacts of tourism that we looked at earlier on in the course. Problems such as litter and water pollution, crime and so on, and, at the same time, to encourage travellers to have a positive impact on the places they visit. Now, there are many other words to describe a similar idea to ecotourism. In fact, the terms alternative tourism, sustainable tourism, or responsible tourism are often used to mean the same thing. But in fact, although the main ideas behind them are similar, there are small differences. And let's briefly look at these now. Alternative tourism is any kind of tourism that is not mass tourism. And by mass tourism, we mean hundreds, if not thousands, of people going on, for example, their 2 weeks a year beach holidays or traditional sightseeing tours. Alternative tourism includes travel such as backpacking and adventure holidays. And the term alternative also includes ecotourism, which is what we are mainly focusing on today. Now, what about sustainable tourism? Sustainable tourism has the same ideals as ecotourism, but it isn't limited to natural areas. So, you can have a sustainable tourist experience in a city or a town. And then we have responsible tourism. What does that mean exactly? Now, basically, this involves acting responsibly and respectfully as a guest when we travel overseas. And what do we mean by respectful? Well, being respectful might involve asking permission to take photographs or go into someone's home observing some of the customs of the local community, such as dress or making an effort to learn the language. Now, ecotourism can be passive or active. So, what do we mean by passive tourism? Well, let's think of some specific examples. A passive tourist might buy their holiday package from a company that donate part of their profits to local charities. Or a passive tourist might book environmentally friendly accommodation. This means choosing to stay in a hotel which may use solar power as a source of energy, or changes sheets and towels for their guests less frequently. Now, active ecotourism's a way for people to enjoy everything that nature has to offer, and at the same time enable them to leave a positive mark on the environment. Now, this kind of ecotourist is sometimes referred to as a voluntourist. That's a combination of volunteer and tourist. You get the idea. Now, voluntourists prefer to experience a new place in an active way. And this doesn't mean sitting in a tourist bus or listening to a pre-recorded guide. Basically, they want to physically connect with the place they're visiting. And this includes connecting with humans and animals. Now, their approach to travel can make a real difference and can really benefit the places and the communities they choose to visit. Voluntourists often help local people construct and repair buildings, or it could mean being willing to help a community with nature conservation. So let's think of some specific examples of this kind of work in action. Now, voluntourists have helped local communities to plant hundreds of trees and installed identifying signs in the rainforests of Costa Rica. They've also helped with sustainable food production in Cuba, and in Jamaica, they've been involved in the cleaning up of local rivers. And in Thailand, they've worked on building ecologically sustainable reforested habitats. Now, some of the work that voluntourists do also involves looking after endangered animals, like the Giant Panda Project in Japan, or the Animal Sanctuary Project in Ecuador. Now, this work doesn't just involve interacting with wildlife, but involves educating local people about the need to protect wildlife. Now, before we explore wildlife tourism in more detail, does anyone have any questions?
That is the end of part 4.
You now have half a minute to check your